Ekatra podcast conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here again to break down big ideas into something, well, essential and hopefully memorable for you. And today, we are really diving deep into something quite amazing, the story of modern Japan's rise.
It really is an astonishing story, and we're leaning heavily on Christopher Gutter Jones's analysis in Modern Japan. His work, it's a fantastic shortcut, really, to grasp how this massive transformation happened, and it challenges a lot of assumptions we tend to have about development globally.
Right, that's exactly the mission today.
Yeah.
How did Japan go from being this, you know, feudal, isolated nation in the mid-1800s to a global powerhouse? And crucially, how did they do it without just becoming a carbon copy of the West? It's almost a blueprint. It is a blueprint, and that's why this deep dive matters for you, the listener. Japan's path basically throws out the window the idea that modernization has to mean westernization. It gives us another way to think about it, you know, how a society or even an organization, maybe even you personally, can embrace huge change, like new tech or new economic models, but still hold on to its core identity, its values.
Okay, before we get into the how, let's talk about the who. Christopher Gutter Jones, he's the scholar guiding us here.
Yeah, and he's not just a historian. He's got this background in Japanese studies and comparative philosophy. That's quite important.
How so? What does the philosophy angle bring?
Well, it means he looks beyond just dates and events. He really digs into the intellectual currents, the philosophical debates happening inside Japan that shape their choices.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the Kyoto School, for instance. He connects that deep thinking to the historical action. He's asking why Japan modernized in its unique way. It's this blend of history and, well, cultural insight.
Got it. So if we zoom out, what's the big idea, the central thesis of his work on modern Japan?
The core idea is that Japan's modern identity wasn't accidental. It was forged through a very deliberate process of selective absorption, adaptation, and synthesis. They looked at foreign influences, German military structure, American education ideas, whatever, not as something to replace their own culture, but as tools. Mm-hmm. Tools to be picked up, adapted, and used for Japan's own goals.
So it's strategic adaptation, not cultural surrender.
Exactly. It's the wakanyusai idea, Japanese spirit, Western techniques.
And that deliberate strategy, that must create some interesting tensions, right? Paradoxes within the country.
No, absolutely. And Gutter Jones really highlights these. They define modern Japan. You've got this constant tension between, you know, deep tradition and relentless innovation.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the pacifist constitution, Article 9, clashing with very real security threats in East Asia today. That's a huge one.
Right.
And maybe the biggest paradox now, the shift from being the post-war economic miracle to a society facing this really profound demographic crunch, aging population, shrinking workforce.
So it sounds like Gutter Jones isn't just describing Japan. He's presenting it as a genuine alternative model of modernity, something different from the standard Western path.
That's precisely it. They didn't just follow. They carved out their own way.
Okay, let's jump into the history then. Let's see this selective adaptation in action. Where should we start? The Big Bang. End of isolation.
Yeah, the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Commodore Perry sails into Tokyo Bay. Suddenly, Japan's centuries of isolation are shattered. They see the West's technological power firsthand. Gunboats and the leadership, the elite, they realize pretty quickly they were facing an existential threat. Adapt or be dominated.
So the Meiji Restoration in 1868 wasn't just a political shift. It was a strategic response to that threat.
Absolutely strategic. It wasn't panic. It was agency. They chose how to respond. And the goal became crystal clear under that famous slogan.
Byuku kishe.
Right. Rich country, strong army. Everything was geared toward that. National survival, national independence. And it was revolutionary, top-down change.
And the speed was incredible. But they weren't just blindly copying, were they?
No, no. Far from it. They were incredibly systematic. They sent missions, delegations all over the world. Study missions. They looked at the British Navy, the German army and bureaucracy, American education, French law. Took bits from everywhere.
But crucially, adapted them.
Yes. Adapted them to fit Japanese conditions, Japanese culture. They kept the emperor system, for example, reinforced traditional hierarchies in new ways.
So the goal wasn't to become French or German. It was to become a stronger Japan using French or German tools.
Precisely. And you see figures like Fukuzawa Yukichi embodying this. He was a huge promoter of Western learning, science, and institutions.
But fiercely protective of Japanese economy and spirit.
Exactly. That's the Wakanyusai principle in action.
Okay. So Meiji was the first major act of selective adaptation. What was the next big rupture? World War II, I assume.
Unquestionably. The defeat in 1945, utter catastrophe, total devastation, and then the American occupation.
Right, General MacArthur. Imposing a new constitution in 1947. Democracy, land reform, a lot of changes forced upon them.
Forced, yes. But even here, Japan adapted the imposed system in its own way. On the surface, you had a Western-style democracy. But underneath, the real power structure that emerged, especially from the mid-50s, was what analysts call the Iron Triangle.
Ah, yes, the Iron Triangle. We hear that term a lot. What exactly was it?
It was this really tight, symbiotic relationship between three players.
Yeah.
The Liberal Democratic Party, which governed almost continuously.
The LDP.
The elite, powerful state bureaucracy, and big businesses, especially the large corporate conglomerates.
The Kiritsu.
The Kiritsu, exactly. These vast networks of interlinked companies, often centered around a main bank.
And why was this triangle so important?
Because it created incredible stability and allowed for coordinated national economic strategy. Hmm. The bureaucracy could guide investment. Industry could plan long-term with support from banks and government. It was perfect for rebuilding and driving that rapid industrial growth. The economic miracle, basically from 1955 right up to around 1990.
So the Iron Triangle fueled the economic engine. But what about the other massive change from the post-war settlement? Article 9. The peace clause.
Ah, yes. Article 9. That's the deep, enduring paradox at the heart of post-war Japan. Renouncing war as a sovereign right. Officially, no standing army, though they have self-defense forces.
And the effect of that?
Well, by essentially outsourcing its national security to the United States through the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, Japan could pour all its energy, all its resources into economic reconstruction and growth. It became this economic giant, but constitutionally, at least, a self-neutered political and military actor. A profound contradiction they still grapple with today.
It's a fascinating trade-off. Okay, let's pull back and summarize the big themes weaving through this history based on Godo Jones. Theme one seems clear. The success of selective modernization.
Yes, and the emphasis is on selective. It wasn't just importing tech. It was a conscious filtering process, identifying what served Japan's goals like factory efficiency or certain governance models, while actively resisting things that clashed with core values. Things like maybe excessive individualism,
yeah,
or ideas that could destabilize their social harmony.
Right. Theme two then gets into the irony. The rise and fall of the Japan model itself, the very things that made the miracle happen eventually became baggage.
Exactly right. It's a sharp irony. Think about those corporate structures.
Hmm.
Lifetime employment, pay based on seniority, intense group loyalty, perfect for the catch-up phase, build loyalty, stability, ensure predictable growth in heavy industry.
Made sense then.
Absolutely. But then the world changes. Globalization hits hard in the 90s. You need agility, fast innovation, disruption. And suddenly, those same structures feel like a cage. Lifetime employment means inflexibility. Seniority blocks young talent. Group conformity stifles radical ideas.
And that contributes to the lost decades.
Significantly. The model that was so successful became rigid, unable to adapt quickly enough to the new global economy.
Which leads us to theme three, the elephant in the room today, the demographic time bomb. You mentioned it's the fundamental challenge now.
It overshadows everything. Japan has the world's oldest population, and it's shrinking fast.
And the consequences are
huge. A smaller workforce supporting a growing number of elderly. Massive strain on pensions and health care. A shrinking domestic market for goods. Rural areas emptying out. Labor shortages pushing automation. It impacts literally every aspect of society and policy. It's the challenge of 21st century Japan.
Wow. Okay, given that gravity, let's distill some of Godo Jones's most powerful insights. He seems to have a knack for cutting through the complexity. What are maybe three core ideas that you, the listener, should really take away?
Okay, three big ones. First, Japan's genius has been its ability to remain Japanese while becoming modern. This just dismantles that old idea that modernization means becoming Western. Japan proved it wrong.
That's a game changer for how we think about development globally. What's the second?
Building on that, he says, Japanese modernity is not incomplete Western modernity, but complete Japanese modernity. It's not a flawed copy, it's its own thing, a unique, successful alternative path in world history.
A complete model in its own right.
Yeah.
Okay. And the third one, about tradition. That sounds counterintuitive.
It is, but it's maybe the insightful. Tradition in Japan was not preserved despite modernization, but because of modernization.
How does that work?
Well, traditional concepts, group loyalty, harmony, hierarchy, weren't just passively kept. They were actively reinterpreted and leveraged to serve modern goals.
Yep.
Think about how company loyalty was cultivated. It used traditional ideas of group obligation to build effective modern corporations. Tradition fueled modernity.
That's fascinating. And it really connects to how we might apply these lessons. Most of us aren't running countries, but we all face change, external pressures. How can we use this selective adaptation idea?
You use it by being really conscious about change. When faced with something new, a technology, a market shift, a new company culture, you have to ask, what's essential here? What's our core strength, our core value, the thing that makes us us? And what's just habit or something that needs updating? You embrace the necessary change, the useful tool, but you actively protect and reinforce that core identity.
Okay, make it concrete. Let's say my company rolls out some big new AI system. Applying the Japan model means what? I learn the AI, but I consciously protect.
Maybe you protect your team's unique way of brainstorming creative solutions. Or maybe it's about preserving your company's reputation for ethical decision-making, even when the AI suggests otherwise for efficiency. The AI changes how you do tasks, but you use the Japan model to ensure it doesn't erode why you're valuable or the core principles of who you are as an organization or even as an individual professional.
So you use the innovation to actually strengthen the core, not let it get washed away. That whack and use idea is incredibly practical. Be an active synthesizer.
Exactly. Don't just passively accept the wave of change. Choose how you ride it.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the final big thought you want to leave with the listener?
I think it's that Japan's story isn't over. Its ongoing struggle reconciling its past identity, its pacifist stance, its global economic role, all under this immense demographic pressure, it's incredibly relevant.
Mm-hmm.
It shows that successful adaptation needs two things: deep self-awareness, knowing what truly matters, and real intellectual creativity to find new ways forward. Japan is like a living lab for challenges many developed nations are starting to face.
That's a really powerful way to put it. A living laboratory. Perhaps Japan's ultimate contribution is proving that modernity doesn't have to be monolithic. It's possible to be fully modern and authentically unique. There's always more than one path. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.